Section D. Under Twombly's construction of Rule 8, we conclude that respondent's complaint has not nudged his claims of invidious discrimination across the line from conceivable to plausible. We begin our analysis by identifying the allegations in the complaint that are not entitled to the assumption of truth. Respondent pleads that petitioners knew of, condoned, and willfully and maliciously agreed to subject him to harsh conditions of confinement as a matter of policy solely on account of his religion, race, and or national origin, and for no legitimate penological interest. The complaint alleges that Ashcroft was the principal architect of this invidious policy, and that Miller was instrumental in adopting and executing it. These bare assertions, much like the pleading of conspiracy in Twombly, amount to nothing more than a formulaic recitation of the elements of the constitutional discrimination claim, namely that petitioners adopted a policy because of, not merely in spite of, its adverse effects upon an identifiable group. As such, the allegations are conclusory and not entitled to be assumed true. To be clear, we do not reject these bold allegations on the ground that they are unrealistic or nonsensical. We do not so characterize them any more than the court in Twombly rejected the plaintiff's express allegation of a contract combination or conspiracy to prevent competitive entry because it thought that claim too chimerical to be maintained. It is the conclusory nature of respondents' allegations, rather than their extravagantly fanciful nature, that this entitles them to the presumption of truth. We next consider the factual allegations in respondents' complaint to determine if they plausibly suggest an entitlement to relief. The complaint alleges that the FBI, under the direction of Defendant Miller, arrested and detained thousands of Arab Muslim men as part of its investigation of the events of September 11th. It further claims that the policy of holding post-September 11th detainees in highly restrictive conditions of confinement until they were cleared by the FBI was approved by defendants Ashcroft and Miller in discussions in the weeks after September 11, 2001. Taken as true, these allegations are consistent with petitioners purposefully designating detainees of high interest because of their race, religion, or national origin. But given more likely explanations, they do not plausibly establish this purpose. September 11th attacks were perpetrated by 19 Arab Muslim hijackers who counted themselves members in good standing of Al-Qaeda, an Islamic fundamentalist group. Al-Qaeda was headed by another Arab Muslim, Osama bin Laden, and composed in large part of his Arab Muslim disciples. It should come as no surprise that a legitimate policy directing law enforcement to arrest and detain individuals because of their suspected link to the attacks would produce a disparate incidental impact on Arab Muslims, even though the purpose of the policy was to target neither Arabs nor Muslims. On the facts, respondent alleges the arrests Miller oversaw were likely lawful and justified by his non-discriminatory intent to detain aliens who were illegally present in the United States and who had potential connections to those who committed terrorist acts. As between that obvious alternative explanation for the arrest and the purposeful invidious discrimination respondent asks us to infer, discrimination is not a plausible conclusion. But even if the complaint's well-pleaded facts give rise to a plausible inference that respondent's arrest was the result of unconstitutional discrimination, that inference alone would not entitle respondent to relief. It is important to recall that respondent's complaint challenges neither the constitutionality of his arrest nor his initial detention in the MDC. Respondent's constitutional claims against petitioners rest solely on their ostensible policy of holding post-September 11th detainees in the ADMAX CHU once they were categorized as of high interest. To prevail on that theory, the complaint must contain facts plausibly showing that petitioners purposefully adopted a policy of classifying post-September 11th detainees as of high interest because of their race, religion, or national origin. This, the complaint fails to do. Though respondent alleges that various other defendants, who are not before us, may have labeled him a person of high interest for impermissible reasons, his only factual allegation against petitioners accuses them of adopting a policy approving restrictive conditions of confinement for post-September 11th detainees until they were cleared by the FBI. Accepting the truth of that allegation, The complaint does not show or even intimate that petitioners purposefully house detainees in the ADMAX SHU due to their race, religion, or national origin. All it plausibly suggests is that the nation's top law enforcement officers, in the aftermath of a devastating terrorist attack, sought to keep suspected terrorists in the most secure conditions available until the suspects could be cleared of terrorist activity. Respondent does not argue, nor can he, that such a motive would violate petitioners' constitutional obligations. He would need to allege more by way of factual content and nudge his claim of purposeful discrimination across the line from conceivable to plausible. To be sure, respondent can attempt to draw certain contrasts between the pleadings the court considered in Twombly and the pleadings at issue here. In Twombly, the complaint alleged general wrongdoing that extended over a period of years, whereas here the complaint alleges discrete wrongs, for instance, beatings, by lower-level government actors. The allegations here, if true and if condoned by petitioners, could be the basis for some inference of wrongful intent on petitioners' part. Despite these distinctions, respondents' pleadings do not suffice to state a claim. Unlike in Twombly, where the doctrine of respondeat superior could bind the corporate defendant, here, as we have noted, petitioners cannot be held liable unless they themselves acted on account of a constitutionally protected characteristic. Yet respondent's complaint does not contain any factual allegation sufficient to plausibly suggest petitioner's discriminatory state of mind. His pleadings, thus, do not meet the standard necessary to comply with Rule 8. It is important to note, however, that we express no opinion concerning the sufficiency of respondent's complaint against the defendants who are not before us. Respondent's account of his prison ordeal alleges serious official misconduct that we need not address here. Our decision is limited to the determination that respondent's complaint does not entitle him to relief from petitioners. Section C. Respondent offers three arguments that bear on our disposition of his case, but none is persuasive. Subsection 1. Respondent first says that our decision in Twombly should be limited to pleadings made in the context of an antitrust dispute. This argument is not supported by Twombly and is incompatible with the federal rules of civil procedure. Though Twombly determined the sufficiency of a complaint sounding in antitrust, the decision was based on our interpretation and application of Rule 8. That rule, in turn, governs the pleading standard in all civil actions and proceedings in the United States District Courts. Our decision in Twombly expounded the pleading standard for all civil actions, and it applies to antitrust and discrimination suits alike. Subsection 2. Respondent next implies that our construction of Rule 8 should be tempered, whereas here the Court of Appeals has instructed the District Court to cabin discovery in such a way as to preserve petitioner's defense of qualified immunity as much as possible in anticipation of a summary judgment motion. We have held, however, that the question presented by a motion to dismiss a complaint for insufficient pleadings does not turn on the controls placed upon the discovery process. It is no answer to say that a claim just shy of a plausible entitlement to relief can, if groundless, be weeded out early in the discovery process through careful case management, given the common lament that the success of judicial supervision in checking discovery abuse has been on the modest side. Our rejection of the careful case management approach is especially important in suits where government official defendants are entitled to assert the defense of qualified immunity. The basic thrust of the qualified immunity doctrine is to free officials from the concerns of litigation, including avoidance of disruptive discovery. There are serious and legitimate reasons for this. If a government official is to devote time to his or her duties and to the formulation of sound and responsible policies, it is counterproductive to require the substantial diversion that is attendant to participating in litigation and making informed decisions as to how it should proceed. Litigation, though necessary to ensure that officials comply with the law, exacts heavy costs in terms of efficiency and expenditure of valuable time and resources that might otherwise be directed to the proper execution of the work of the government. The costs of diversion are only magnified when government officials are charged with responding to, as Judge Cabranes aptly put it, a national and international security emergency unprecedented in the history of the American Republic. It is no answer to these concerns to say that discovery for petitioners can be deferred while pretrial proceedings continue for other defendants. It is quite likely that when discovery as to the other parties proceeds, it would prove necessary for petitioners and their counsel to participate in the process to ensure that the case does not develop in a misleading or slanted way that causes prejudice to their position. Even if petitioners are not yet themselves subject to discovery orders then, they would not be free from the burdens of discovery. We decline respondents' invitation to relax the pleading requirements on the ground that the Court of Appeals promises petitioners minimally intrusive discovery. That promise provides especially cold comfort in this pleading context, where we are impelled to give real content to the concept of qualified immunity for high-level officials who must be neither deterred nor detracted from the vigorous performance of their duties. Because respondent's complaint is deficient under Rule 8, he is not entitled to discovery, cabined or otherwise. Subsection 3. Respondent finally maintains that the federal rules expressly allow him to allege petitioner's discriminatory intent generally, which he equates with a conclusory allegation. It follows, respondent says, that his complaint is sufficiently well pleaded because it claims that petitioners discriminated against him on account of his religion, race, and or national origin, and for no legitimate penological interest. Were we required to accept this allegation as true, respondent's complaint would survive petitioner's motion to dismiss. But the federal rules do not require courts to credit a complaint's conclusory statements without reference to its factual context. It is true that Rule 9b requires particularity when pleading fraud or mistake, while allowing malice, intent, knowledge, and other conditions of a person's mind to be alleged generally. But generally is a relative term. In the context of Rule 9, it is to be compared to the particularity requirement applicable to fraud or mistake. Rule 9 merely excuses a party from pleading discriminatory intent under an elevated pleading standard. It does not give him license to evade the less rigid, though still operative, strictures of Rule 8. And Rule 8 does not empower a respondent to plead the bare elements of his cause of action, affix the label general allegation, and expect his complaint to survive a motion to dismiss. Part 5. We hold that respondent's complaint fails to plead sufficient facts to state a claim for purposeful and unlawful discrimination against petitioners. The Court of Appeals should decide in the first instance whether to remand to the District Court so that respondent can seek leave to amend his deficient complaint. The judgment of the Court of Appeals is reversed, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. It is so ordered.